Hello everyone, welcome back to just another F1 podcast here on Apex Motorsport. My name is Richard Smith and this is Season 5, Episode 5. And welcome to a new era of the podcast where we take a look at the good, the bad and the controversial moments from the world of Formula 1 as well as recapping the major news stories since the previous episode. And joining me today is, as always, Ryan Colwell and Tom Toseland. Ryan, I'll start with you. We've seen in Australia that Max Verstappen is human after all, but he was back to his best in Japan. What have you made of his start to the season so far?
Well, Max as a whole package is just still on another level. The cars behind him, his teammates behind him, more importantly, he's just a different breed of a man. You can just tell that he's had this success story coming for him for a long time. He's gonna win everything, let's be honest. As for what happened in Australia, it wasn't exactly his fault. It was probably down to whoever decided to fit the brakes incorrectly or whatever happened. But things happen, reliability issues happen. It wasn't even reliability, but mechanical things happen and there's nothing you can do about it. He's probably laughing about it now, but I'd say at the time he threw a mini tantrum and went and told Daddy that the car was no longer suitable enough for him and that he has to go to Mercedes next year. I don't know. But no, Max is off to a flyer and hopefully Carlos Sainz can do something about it.
Yeah, and Tom, it was a busy weekend for sport. Usually when Formula 1's on in the early hours of the morning, it's usually okay. People can get up and watch it and there's nothing else going on. But there was WrestleMania this weekend as well. I know you're a big fan of that. So did you manage to cram in both or did you have to sacrifice one to get some precious sleep in?
I sacrificed the Formula 1 for the wrestling, really. I made sure I had the Formula 1 on recording and then I watched it when I woke up in the morning after watching WrestleMania, because obviously F1 is on all year, WrestleMania is only once a year, so you had to prioritise that. So yeah, it was a little bit tricky, but it was a decent race in the end. There was some kind of different tyre strategies going on, so Sainz near the end had to try and make his way back up through the field and also Lando trying something different as well from what I remember. So at least it was a decent race, and then when it was a little bit slow at times, you can always just a little fast forward to when it gets interesting again.
Yeah, I suppose you did have the opportunity to skip forward through the red flag that definitely wasn't very welcome. Yeah, whenever for first lap when you're just about a wreck and then you know it's going to be a half hour delay, so you either risk it and take a nap or make a cup of tea. I chose the latter because I just knew things were going to get back underway fairly soon. But next weekend, we go back to China. We haven't had a Chinese Grand Prix since 2019, which is a scary thought. Obviously, we had the massive global pandemic, and then we've had concerns since about China as well. But as it stands, the race is going ahead. I think this is the first year there hasn't been talk about the race being cancelled, so it's still on the calendar, and it's also the first sprint race of the weekend, sprint weekend of the season, I should say. We're all really excited for that, aren't we? Sprint racing is back. It's our favourite thing, especially when it's at 4 o'clock in the morning. Ryan, China's back. Are you looking forward to it?
I happen to end up going out again like I did for Australia, I will definitely be watching it because that's about the time I would get home. But as for China being back, it was one of the first races, I believe, that was cancelled at the time, obviously due to the whole madness that went on in the good old 2000. But also it's about time we bring it back. It's the last time we had the Chinese Grand Prix, Alpine were Renault. Scuderia Toro Rosso existed with a driver such as Daniel Kvyat. We had Robert Kubica in the Mercedes Williams. We also had Jesus Antonio Giovinazzi in an Alfa Romeo. We also had the one and only Kimi Räikkönen. Like, come on, guys. And also, it's China. Everyone loves China, especially big old Donald. We love China. What I'm probably most excited for in this race is that it is very narrow at the start, which is probably my favorite part about this track. I am so glad it's back. I cannot wait, and we are going to see a lot of cars going off. Logan Sargeant and Lance Stroll, not making bold predictions already, but that's definitely going to happen. If not, Charles, because he's going to be pushing too hard trying to catch up to his superstar boy, speedy teammate, Carlos Sainz. I feel bad for you, Charles, but yeah, the wrong man's losing his seat. Let's put it like that.
I'm just taking a look at the schedule for the Chinese Grand Prix, and we're in this run of the early morning races, and usually Japan's the outlier. It's later in the season where we have this big European run of 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon races, and it's fine, and then we've got 6 in the morning, but we're having this run. It's progressively getting later. We had Australia at 4 in the morning, we had Japan at 6 in the morning, and we've got China at 8 in the morning, so it's not the worst in the world, that's for sure. But it's the first time we're seeing this new format for the sprint weekend, something that we said numerous times last year in the podcast, that this is the sort of format that we would like to see if they want to stick with these sprint races. So practice one, the only practice session, is going to be at 4:30 in the UK time on Friday, which will be followed by sprint qualifying on Friday evening, I assume, in China, at 8:30 a.m. And that's a change from last year, where on the sprint weekend in 2023, qualifying on a Friday was for the Grand Prix, where this year it's for the actual sprint. And then the sprint race itself, or we still can't call it the sprint race, just want to call it the sprint, takes place at 4 a.m. on the Saturday morning, with qualifying for the actual Grand Prix later on the day at 8 a.m. in the UK, with the race as normal on the Sunday. Tom, what do you make of these changes? Do you think this is the right formula now for the sprint weekend, where we have a practice session, then we get the sprint out of the way, and it's over 2 days, so you know, it's still going to be the main feature of the weekend because it's on Friday and on a Saturday, but we're getting that out of the way, and then everyone can then focus for qualifying, which I'm not 100% sure, but I don't know when Parc Fermé is going to come into play, because I would assume now that it won't come into play until Saturday qualifying, which would mean that the sprint could be used as a bit of an experiment for especially some of the teams lower down in the midfield. Just, Tom, do you think this is the right way going forward?
Yeah, I'm still not a massive fan of the sprints in general. I just they do add a little bit of kind of jeopardy to the weekend in how drivers can go off the circuit and damage their cars right before a race. But they just never feel very natural, and they just don't offer a lot, to be fair. There's not been that many really, like, people don't go back to the weekend and go, wow, I really enjoyed that sprint. It's as I've been saying this whole time, it's kind of with the build up of it, it's not really, it kind of ruins the whole build up of the weekend, because with practice and qualifying then the race, you've got that nice build up of getting more hyped for the weekend as it gets more serious as it goes on. It kind of feels like having the sprint, it kind of peaks too early, if that makes sense. It's like having a bit of your birthday cake before your birthday. You're being treated to a race before you're supposed to. So I feel like, yeah, maybe it's a better formatted now, but they're still not really been that great over the last couple of seasons. I think they've worked in previous seasons, but obviously Magnussen got pole. I think it was last year he got pole at Brazil, or it might have been 2 years ago now. And then obviously Hamilton had one of his main races in the 2021 season was the sprint in Brazil, helping him make his way back up the field. But yeah, at the end of the day, I don't know. I don't feel like they actually offer that much to the weekend.
Yeah, I think for me, there is only two standout moments about sprint races, sprint weekends, standout to me. It's the two you mentioned there, the Magnussen pole and the Hamilton sort of drive through the field. And, you know, if you could argue a point of if there wasn't a sprint that weekend in Brazil, he wouldn't have maybe gone on to win that race, and he might not have been in with a chance of obviously being in a title fight going into Abu Dhabi. That's another one that's every podcast so far since. But yeah, for me, I'm still a massive fan of them. I understand why they're doing them, but I feel like it's one of these things. You either do them every race or not at all, and I don't think they can do them every race because you're completely changing up a format of something that has worked for 70 plus years. You can change up how qualifying is done, you can change up that, but the Grand Prix itself is the Grand Prix. Teams need practice sessions, and without them, you know, it would be absolute chaos if, say, they'd done sprints every single weekend. Every team having one practice session, it wouldn't be ideal. It is also a home race for Zhou Guanyu. And I think I seen somewhere that there's six drivers on the grid who've never raced in China, which is a pretty bizarre thing when you look at the calendar. Now, you can understand maybe one or two rookie drivers coming in that haven't raced in some of the circuits that F2 didn't go to, but six drivers in this grid just shows you how long it's been since we last raced there. But let's take a little bit of a step back from China, and let's talk about a rumour that's been going around in the world of Formula 1. We've previously discussed, obviously, Hamilton joining Ferrari, and we've also discussed the possibility for Verstappen going to Mercedes, Fernando Alonso going to Red Bull. But one driver who has thrown his name into the mix this week, he's doing the rounds of the British media promoting his new energy drink, Sebastian Vettel, hinting that he's had conversations with Toto Wolff, and he is open to a comeback if it's with the right team. Ryan, Sebastian Vettel to Mercedes, can you see it happening?
German driver, German team, absolutely, it's possible. Age difference, he might only get a year, let's be honest. Mercedes are famous for offering one-year contracts to people who they don't see long-term. But he could provide some short-term stability. However, what he has on his CV over the last 3 years isn't exactly what Carlos Sainz is going to have on his CV by the end of this year, by the way he's going. So I can see them possibly taking Sainz over Vettel. But it would be unreal to have Vettel back. He's always wanted to drive in a Mercedes because he wanted to drive everywhere that Michael drove. Michael Schumacher, I'm referencing. Michael drove a Mercedes. Vettel has not. Vettel has drove the Ferrari. Michael has drove a Ferrari. Michael drove a Red Bull. So did he.
Oh, no, he didn't. Red Bull is Sebastian's favourite.
Let's see. Mercedes, is it possible? It is. It is possible. Money-wise, don't know how much he'd actually be willing to go back for. But if Mercedes did offer them the possibility and Sainz got sorted out elsewhere, which is very unlikely unless he wants to go to Williams for a year, I don't know. Unless Red Bull decide to take on Sainz, bring him back into the Red Bull family, but then I'm pretty sure he's smart enough not to do that, as is nearly everyone who goes to Red Bull. But you never know. It's going to come up to soon. Soon's going to come up to silly season very, very shortly within the next 2 months. So we just got to keep on top of the news and see where these little nibs and nabs of stories go.
Well, you did bring him up. I was going to mention that it wouldn't be the first time that Mercedes have brought back a retired German driver to race for the team, because obviously they did that with Michael Schumacher, who signed with them just before his 41st birthday. Vettel's only 36. He'll be 37 by the time next season comes around. So you, and you look at the grid, you got Hamilton, you got Alonso. Like he's, he, I still think Vettel retired a little bit too early. But I feel like for him, it was the right time to retire. Especially when you're moving back further down the grid. Obviously, we've seen what's happened with Aston Martin since, but he was slipping back. Tom, what's your take on this Vettel to Mercedes, or just Vettel back to Formula 1 in general? Is that something that you could see happening?
I think it depends. He's kind of, he said in an interview, well, while testing the Porsche as well, because obviously he's been testing the Porsche for the Le Mans 24 hours ahead of that and deciding if he wants to take part in that as well. So I think it's, he says in the article that he's still deciding on what he wants to do in his future of motorsport. So I think the thing is that, yes, there is Mercedes rumours, but I mean, there's also an opportunity for him to go and do something completely different, like the World Endurance Championship. So, I mean, to be fair, I don't think it is this, but he could just be doing this to show Porsche that he is still a big name in motorsport and that he probably would be a good fit for that seat because he can bring a lot of media attention to them, as he's shown by hinting that he could return to F1. I don't know if that is the case, but yeah, he said he's still deciding what he wants to do with into his future in motorsport. And the thing is with Porsche have been very quick since they've since we've come back from the winter break in the World Endurance Championship, and even IMSA, I know they both took somewhat different regulations, but they've won the Daytona 24 hour, they won the Qatar race as well, so the car is obviously working very well now after a season of running it. So he's really getting into a car that, even though it wasn't competitive at Le Mans last year, going into this year on its current form will be a car that's running near the front of the field. So with all that being said, that's the thing. It's, does he potentially want to try and do, name that comes to mind, Nico Hülkenberg, and potentially do a one-off Le Mans stint with Porsche and then, and while also looking at doing F1, or is it rather he's going to choose one or the other? And well, if I was him, I know it's F1's the pinnacle of everything, but with Porsche's current form, it's a much, much easier way of adding to his reputation by racing with them at the Le Mans 24 hour, because I think he's probably got more chance of getting that accolade than potentially another F1 race win with Mercedes, because we were speaking before, and their media admin has done, if you don't love me at my worst, and it's picture of this year's car, you don't deserve me at my, and then it's a picture of the 2020 car. So it's obviously, they're not in a great position.
No, there's definitely something up at Mercedes. We'll talk about them in just a second, but I just want to quickly bring back a point to Vettel. He said, was it when he retired or afterwards, that there's still a race left to win. And I think for me, every indication is that's Le Mans. I know it's reference of the climate change and his work there, but I think it's an indirect quote of he wants to continue racing in some capacity. And I think, Tom, Le Mans is where I could see him. It's going to Porsche, and I could also see potentially a link up with the Formula E team, because I know there's a lot of disruption with Antonio Felix da Costa at the moment. Nico Müller, who isn't even racing for the team, he's racing for another team, is testing the car mid-season. It's just utter chaos there.
And he's a Peugeot World Endurance Championship driver as well. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. But let's talk about Mercedes, because they are in a pretty bad state at the moment. I think it's a point I thought about a few days back. If Vettel did return to Mercedes, it would be interesting, because going back to whenever Hamilton was, with the Hamilton v Vettel days, the Mercedes v Ferrari, when they were fighting for race wins, I think 2017, 2018, that sort of era, there was very much, you had the Mercedes fans who were very for Hamilton and had hatred for Vettel. Hatred may be too strong a word, but a dislike for Vettel because he was a rival. It's just national sport. if Vettel make it, you know, joins Mercedes, that's going to create an interesting dynamic, because you'll have Lewis Hamilton driving for Ferrari and Sebastian Vettel racing for Mercedes. The rules are completely reversed, so it'll be interesting to see where the fan bases lie on that. But Ryan, just your take on Mercedes at the moment, because they're obviously behind Red Bull, they're behind Ferrari, they're behind McLaren, and you could argue that they're behind Fernando Alonso, not necessarily Lance Stroll, but definitely one of the Aston Martins. Given the two drivers they have, Lewis Hamilton, 7-time world champion, George Russell, hotly tipped to be a future world champion, they need to be doing better than where they are currently.
Yeah, definitely. But the way I see it is driver profiles makes a big difference in a team to result in change. You look at Hamilton and Bottas, the reason that team was so successful was because the two of them worked in unison with each other. They both helped develop that car to a point where if something wasn't right with one, the other could either recognize the same fault and they would both ratify it and say, yes, that feels much better. We now feel more confident that the car feels better in the corners, feels better in the braking zones, feels better at high speed. They were able to give such really good in-depth feedback, which is why the team was so successful for the last, you know, for their run of 7 years. Well, eight, really. But you look at now, George, I don't mean to say it, but he seems like a bit of a posh one of them boys, you know, sort of, I can't say the word, but
he's become very arrogant.
He has become self-centered of himself.
Yeah.
This would be the best way. He thinks he is the dog's bollocks, is the most simplest way of putting it. He thinks he is the best person on that grid. He think, you know, you see him, he was always, like, you can't say he's posing like mad, because he's always been like that since he first got into Formula One. He's a poser. But the way his attitude is towards Hamilton, someone he's idolized since he was a kid, and sort of just pushes him to the side now and says, well, he's just not good enough to keep up with me. Man, you're not that good. You got that one lucky chance back in Sakir. Now, don't get me wrong. It was great to see him go from a Williams to a Mercedes and be dominant instantly. But ever since he's then got that contract knuckled down, he's just sort of been so full of himself to the point where I'm like, he's not the sort of guy that develops a team. He's the sort of boy that's expecting the team to develop for him, which is where it's leaving Hamilton in such a tricky spot. I feel like Hamilton's doing all the feedback, as he's done for years and years and years, but he's just not getting that same rapport, would be the fancy word, with Russell between him and Bottas. So I feel that's why the team's definitely taken a lot longer to come back to where they once were. But Hamilton, on the other hand, as a driver, he's definitely still got pace. But when you compare him to Russell at the moment, Russell is generally faster. Whether that's just down to individual car setup, that's a whole different ball game, because every weekend's different, every driver feels different in certain tracks and stuff. But then you compare him to the likes of Alonso, and you're like, Alonso, you would argue, yes, is in better machinery at the minute, but even last season, actually, well, last season was a lot better for Aston Martin, let's be honest. At the start, even you go to end of the season for Aston Martin, Alonso was still pushing that car to the point where he was starting to catch Mercedes. He was on the back heels of Mercedes, which means his driver talent at 41, 42 now, is he not? He's just unbelievable. Hamilton is still catching up. He's still there. He's still in the ball game. As long as his reaction times and his driving skill and his mental capabilities for race weekends is still there, he's still a top level, top tier driver. He is technically one of the greatest of all times. Technically not the greatest. He hasn't got that IF championship yet. Oh, I don't know where to go with this. Like, Mercedes in such a rut that they're just stuck at a point where, is it a development issue? Is it a fact that they just don't have enough engineering time, such as wind tunnel time left, that they don't want to overstretch it and then not be able to develop in the second half of the season when they really need that extra boost if everyone else starts to clamber on top and getting past them again? As you said, they're pretty much fourth to fifth in the championship after Alonso as a solo driver. Even their own, even a team they supply engines to is doing better than them. It's like
two teams.
Oh yes, Alonso on his own, yeah. quote. But it's, you look at that and you're like, so what are we doing wrong that they can extract the power and the aero package, and it works for them, but it's not working for us, the team that actually own the engines, the team that, you know, maybe gives them a slightly very different engine than what we have. It just baffles my mind. You always would assume the works team would be the one that has the benefits. Like, look at Ferrari. Ferrari is the second fastest team, but you don't see Haas and you don't see Steak flying up in the top, you know, the top four positions all the time. No, they're still at the bottom because they don't have that research and development. It's the same as Mercedes, but Mercedes is the other way around. They supply the engines, but everyone else who has their engines does so much better. Oh, Mercedes, they're having an absolute, like, Alpine moment where things just isn't working. Oh, I don't know what's going on over there, but something needs to change. And if they ever want to get back to beating Max Verstappen, they need to do something about it ASAP.
Yeah, I think for Mercedes, it's at the point where they just need to write off this season and next season and wait for the rules changes. Especially when you've got Hamilton going to Ferrari next year. You don't want to be sharing too much in the development of the car to a driver who will probably go and share some of them secrets to Ferrari, because there's no amount of non-disclosure agreements and stuff you can sign that, you know, something will slip, or I think you should change that. It'll happen somewhere. But I think, you know, I drive past Mercedes Base at Brackley twice a week, if not more, and I was very surprised on Sunday night driving back. Now, I get they're maybe all working on the Japan schedule, but their base was complete darkness. I was thinking, if you've had a result this bad, surely you would have a team that's just working round the clock to make improvements and just completely just ignore the fact that they were so bad. And I've drove past quite a few times where it's just been completely darkness. There's been other times where there's been lights on, but I was very surprised by that, thinking that, you know, to me it's sort of the fact that they're just taking it as it is. That's what the car's capable of. And I think, and I'll throw this question to you, Tom, next season obviously they have to replace Hamilton. We know that the rumors of signs potentially going as well, alongside Vettel. But the one name that's probably most likely at the moment is Kimi Antonelli, Formula 2 driver. I think he actually has enough to get a super license at this moment. But could you see Mercedes putting him into the seat basically right now of next season and basically going, here's a year where you can develop what you want in a car that will still get you points? When we're saying Mercedes are quite bad at the moment, they're still getting double points every race. You know, it's not, unless Hamilton obviously didn't finish in Australia, but whenever they finish, they're still up there in the top 10. Could you see Mercedes put Antonelli in beside Russell to give him a year to just basically develop, learn, and being told there's no pressure, this is a better environment for you to be in than, say, Williams? Because I've seen a report where they were letting test one of their old cars and was from the previous generation, and was basically the response to why was, we want to get them to test a car that's actually good and drives well.
I don't think, in terms of Antonelli, I don't think Antonelli is at a point where you can put him in that car yet. I think he hasn't really been... we're only a couple races into the Formula 2 season. Now, actually, I think we're 3, to be exact, into the Formula 2 season. And he's currently... Well, I don't think he's even... I'm not sure where he even is in the driver standings. But he hasn't had great races from what I... he's in... after round 3 in Australia, he's in... he was in 9th, and then he had a little spin as well in Australia, and he's not really been at a point where he's felt like he's a driver that you can take from Formula 2 into a Formula 1 seat, because it's just he's had like his moments, but he's not really been there. He's not been that guy. He's not been the Piastri level of Formula 2 just yet. And I mean, there's still a whole half of that. Well, even there's still many rounds to go in that season where he could obviously turn it around. But current form, I don't see him taking that seat. And another reason I wouldn't want him to take that seat as well is like what Ryan was saying. I don't think Russell has that ability to run the team. He does come across as a bit arrogant sometimes, and he doesn't seem like he's got that kind of ability to get the team to rally around him, because he's not, I mean, this might be just coming from the outside in, but he hasn't got that kind of same likeable attitude. There is a little bit of arrogance about him, and I think that can rub people the wrong way, and it could rub people the wrong way in the team. I don't know. It seems like he hasn't got that ability to get a team around him. So I think what you'd want, instead of someone young like Antonelli or maybe even Sainz, I think you'd want someone like Sebastian Vettel, like Fernando Alonso, people who have an established record of knowing how to set up cars and get, well, actually, I say get teams rallied around them, but we won't talk about Honda and Alonso.
GP2 engine.
Yes. But you need someone, I think Vettel, to be honest, is ideal, because you need someone in that seat who, proven track record, can get a team around them. And well, I think Vettel did that. I think he did do that at Ferrari, to be fair. I think it was just he kind of lost out to Leclerc in the final couple of years, and just really a few, well, not unlucky situations, but kind of bad luck, but mistakes on his part at Ferrari that many didn't win a world championship. But anyway, back to my point I was saying, I think he is a driver that has got Red Bull and Ferrari to back him, and has really improved the team while he's been there. So I think you'd rather go for someone experienced like that than an Antonelli and George Russell lineup, because I don't think that is the style of lineup that is going to propel you to the front of the field, because there'd be such little experience from the pair of them. So I think you'd need someone, an older driver, that can come in and be like, well, we need to do this, this and this, and this is how the car feels, and just someone who has that experience to really lead the team in the right direction.
Yeah, let's go on to a little bit of a quick fire round now. I'm going to ask you three questions, and I want a response in just a few words. So Ryan, I'll start with you. A few weeks back, we've seen Williams give Alex Albon Logan Sargeant's car after Albon crashed his. Were Williams right to give Albon Sargeant's car?
Very quickly, in the grand scheme of things, I would agree with that point, because Sargeant has not been capable of getting into the points, whereas his teammate has been capable of doing that and has a lot more experience, so I would do that. However, that is only based on the fact that Williams is desperate for points. They need these points. If the tables was turned and it was, say they were top four, I'd say that's totally wrong, because both drivers would have been at that point totally capable of scoring points if they were both sitting up. You know, if the team is sitting up in fourth, they're both fully capable of scoring points. So I would not have swapped the drivers. I would have let the driver who did not crash his car drive the race. I think that's why Logan crashed out this weekend, to make sure Albon could not steal his car.
Tom, your thoughts on that?
I think it was the writing on the walls for Sargeant. I think that shows how much confidence the team have in him. And I feel like probably it was right to do that, because I think Albon is the one that's probably going to be, he's going to score you points. Yeah. I don't think Sargeant's been necessarily awful recently. I think there is a slight improvement in his driving, and he is looking a little bit more competitive. But the issue is he does struggle to keep it on the circuit. I feel like it really is the writing on the walls for him, showing the team really have that little faith in him, and that, well, I mean, if he doesn't improve quickly, I think he could be out before the end of this season.
Yeah, my thoughts on that is my respect for James Vowles increased massively, purely on the fact of that was a really tough call to make. And yes, it's obviously disappointing. I'm sure Sargeant was very upset about it, but it was what Well, James Vowles made the decision based on the best interest for the team, the most realistic chance of scoring points, and that, I think, is the sort of decisions that need to be made at that level if you're a team like Williams and you want to progress up the field. So it was a tough call to make. I wouldn't have wanted to be in that position myself, but full respect to Vowles for making that. Tom, start with you in this one. We've seen at the end of the Australian race, Fernando Alonso, brake check, George Russell, the descent of Russell upside down, keeping with the theme of Russell not crashing out of every race that Sainz has won, or at least not finishing every race Sainz has won. With Crofdale's saying a commentary, I forget the line now, but he says something, sees a checkered flag or something like that, and then Russell's upside down. Tom, did Alonso, well, we've obviously seen it. Was Alonso right to break check Russell? Do you think it was within the rules or not?
I'm going to my GT touring car side of racing. I think it was right. I think it's like, obviously what he's trying to do is back him up so then Russell lets off, and then it would have compromised Russell onto that, well, not so straight part of the circuit, but is that kind of big long S straight, whatever you want to call it. It would have compromised Russell onto that and would have probably given Alonso a better opportunity to holding on to his position. And the thing is, it depends what angle of the accident you see, because sometimes when you see it from Alonso's rear wing, it looks like Russell should react to Alonso slowing down and shouldn't throw the car off the circuit. But then when you see it from Russell's point of view, it obviously all happens quite quickly, and he comes right at the back of the Aston Martin, and there's nothing really he can do about it. But actually saying that, though, I don't know. I feel like it's something you see in racing all the time. You see it in a touring car a lot. You see it in the GTs a lot as well. Obviously, that normally leads to a little bit of a bump on the rear, but I think it is well within the rules, and I think it's, I don't know, I feel like sometimes F1 doesn't help itself with creating decent racing, because sometimes they just take away a bit from traditional motorsport, because I think that's a tactic you'd see across a lot of other series, but obviously F1 are being a little bit kind of strict on the rules, but it is a bit of an interesting situation, because I mean, well, yeah, I can see both arguments, because obviously I think it is a move that is used in motorsport and probably shouldn't be penalised, but and again, in that situation, it does all happen quite quickly, and you are moving at a lot higher speeds than other series, and obviously a contact isn't as permitted / wanted because the cars are so fragile. So I'm gonna stick with, I think it's a wrong they gave him the penalty, but I can see both sides.
Yeah, I think it was well within Sir Alonso's rights to do that. Was it, you know, if in the rule book, I think he was okay, but if you're looking more, you know, fair driving, well, everyone's been brake checked before. He's a quick enough driver. He should be able to anticipate something like that happening. Brian, do you think he was right to do it, or do you think it was a little bit cheeky from Alonso?
All I'm going to say is it's not as bad as the time Vettel brake checked Hamilton in Azerbaijan, was it, I think? When he overtook him, slammed the brakes, and then Hamilton on the back of him. That's a different story. That was deliberate action. This seems more of like I'm going to let off the throttle just that wee bit earlier. You're not going to be expecting it. You're going to come in far too hot because it's the second last lap. You're really pushing to try and pass me, and you've made a mistake now. You've messed it up because you couldn't control your car because I lifted off that wee bit more earlier and may have applied a wee bit more brake pressure. I wouldn't have, like, if he was properly brake testing him in that corner, let's be honest, we would have seen a lot more telemetry data showing a massive spike. There wasn't even that big of a spike. You've seen the liftoff in engine RPM and you see the tiniest bit of brake pressure. But that was probably just because if he lifted off too early, the car's going to be unsettled going through, so he had to apply a wee bit of brake pressure just to keep himself pointing the right direction himself. You know, like, you can see the tactic in it. He kept Hamilton behind for Esteban Ocon that time? Like, God knows how many times Alonso pulled that sort of sneaky move on Hamilton, and Hamilton never went into the back of him or went off track. Like, I bet you if we go back to that race and get the exact telemetry of when he was holding back, I'm just saying Hamilton, I'm not entirely sure if it was or not, but I guarantee you Alonso was doing the exact same tricks come the end of the race, just holding off, trying everything in his playbook just to keep him behind. I do think the penalty was a wee bit harsh for what they give him. It's a 50-50, really. You can see that he has done it himself. He has went earlier and slowed off and lifted a lot earlier than what normally would be normal on a lap-per-lap basis. But at the same time, Russell shouldn't be that pumped up on adrenaline to be trying to push that hard. He should have waited for the straight, kept on his backside, and gone at the straight under DRS. I don't know why he was trying to dive so hard into that corner at the same time. So I'd say it's unfair on Alonso, because I do think George was pushing just maybe a wee bit too hard, thinking that he was going to do some big massive points for Mercedes, I think, as he was the only driver at the time in the race for Mercedes.
Yeah. I think if Russell didn't end up upside down, I don't think Alonso would have got a penalty. I think it's just
red flag, yeah. I'm upside down, red flag, red.
Yeah, with the red flag, ultimately would have given him the points if it had been called. Although, I do understand he was calling purely for a safety, because I'm sure being upside down in a car in a blind corner in the middle of the track is quite scary. He wouldn't want to be in that position.
Especially with Lance Stroll coming behind you.
yeah. One word answers on this one, sort of not allowing you to present any context for this, which probably makes your decision a little bit more difficult. But the question is, and Tom, I'll start with you, is Daniel Ricciardo under pressure of losing his seat? Yes or no?
Yeah, no, I think he is, because I think he's not been fantastic, really. He's not been the driver he was four years ago, to be fair. He's been rather a ghost, really. It's not like, wow, look, there's Daniel Ricciardo. It's just like, oh, look, there's AlphaTauri, or whatever it's called. Now RB Racing, whatever, I forgot what it's called. It's just he's kind of just another driver. He is kind of just like an Antonio Giovinazzi sometimes. I think he's just there. He's not really setting the world on fire, and obviously he didn't finish this weekend, and that really was that in a move that where it looked like he was trying to move out the way of Stroll, but then it probably Stroll wasn't even close to him, so I don't know, he kind of maybe a lack of awareness to where Albon was around him, and he's just not looked very impressive. He looks like he's kind of gone into that unconfident Sebastian Vettel the German track, it's not Nürburgring, it's
Hockenheim,
yeah, post Vettel post Hockenheim 2018 kind of level, where he's kind of lost all his confidence and kind of lost his raw pace, like Vettel did for a couple of years until we kind of reclaimed a little bit of that pace the year he retired. But yeah, it's just kind of like he seems to be lacking confidence, and it just seems to be affecting his driving, I think. And yeah, I think the pressure is well and truly on him at the moment.
There was actually a photo that was quite poetic.
It was him watching on in Japan, the timing screen, not the timing screen, but like the video, and it's Liam Lawson standing behind him watching it as well, just kind of a visual representation of the pressure he's under.
Yeah, I was about to say no, and then I was going to say give him until the summer break, and then we'll reevaluate.
Okay.
That's the short answer you were looking for.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think he is under pressure. And Ryan, I'll come to you in this final point before we go to predictions. We've seen recently that Liberty Media, the owners of Formula One, have bought Dorna, which are the owners of MotoGP and World Superbikes. And we've heard that their main target market is, of course, the United States of America, because where isn't under Liberty Media? And it's also saddens me in a way that it seems to be the World Superbikes is sort of being pushed aside, and they're really trying to make MotoGP the equivalent of Formula One in the world of motorbike racing, which it is. MotoGP is considerably bigger than the World Superbike Championship, but for me, I much prefer the World Superbike Championship. Local interest, John Hray, etc., help that, but I think it's just, for me, it's more competitive in a way. But Ryan, what's your thoughts on this, obviously being a fan of bike racing? Do you think this is a good move, or do you think that for the MotoGP, it's a good thing, but for every other brand that they own, and for even more local racing, British Superbikes, obviously owned by MSV, but on a bigger scale, it's going to make things a lot more difficult, where we're not going to see the likes of, you know, Tyrone McKenzie and the British Superbikes rock up to the Donington Park for the World Superbike British round for a wildcard entry. It's going to make things more difficult in that way.
In the financial aspect of Liberty Media owning it, and I genuinely, for whenever I seen the news, I thought it was an April Fool's joke. I was like, haha, very funny. Yeah, that's kind of funny. Haha, Liberty Media owning MotoGP, they're going to destroy it. And I was just like, yeah, that's not happening. And then it was true. And then I was very disappointed because, I'll start off with what I was going to say, the financial aspect. They were able to turn around Formula One from getting close to negative revenue, well, not revenue, but negative net profits. So they've done good in that, but that's obviously helped from Netflix and bringing in a younger audience, which I suppose MotoGP falls under that category, because anyone who watches bikes either only watches it because their dad watches it, or someone is just interested in motorbikes. It's very niche, whereas Formula One's now become personality based, so people are very big fans of the drivers themselves, or they really like the way the team's color schemes are, and you know, it's got very, I don't know how to put it, but it's gotten very wild, shall we say. MotoGP is very much, here's your teams, here's your riders. They go fast around tracks and lean at angles that are completely insane for a motor vehicle to stay gripped up on a track for. That's about the height of it. Like, I love the bikes. I love seeing the bikes. I love watching motor racing live. But MotoGP, I never actually sit down and watch a MotoGP race because it doesn't have that same one-to-one connection. Now, this is where I feel Liberty Media is going to be able to do that. They're going to be able to expand upon what's already actually a really good platform of MotoGP and World Superbikes. Now, as you've said, they're possibly going to try and push that away to the side and focus solely on MotoGP, which I suppose is okay as long as they keep World Superbikes as it is and they don't degrade it anymore. But to extend MotoGP to make it this bigger thing will ultimately indirectly push fans towards watching World Superbikes as well, because there's a correlation, direct connection sort of thing between the two. For sponsorship reasons, money's going to come into the teams. Teams are going to be financially more better off because it costs a lot for the teams, as it does in Formula One, but obviously bigger sponsorships come into Formula One now. Teams are a lot far better off than they were. You don't hear of many teams facing big financial struggles anymore. Even Williams isn't that bad anymore. Whereas MotoGP, it's just the teams, it's fuel, it's tires. Tires is mental for MotoGP. Pit stops, it's very interesting for MotoGP compared to Formula One. Yeah, it's not 2.2 seconds or the fastest 1.6 or 1.8 seconds, whatever it is. Yeah, it's quite a bit longer, and 9 times out of 10, they're swapping bikes like Formula E does. But I tell you what, it is great to watch clips and highlights of when things are really going well. So their audience is now trying to grasp the likes of me to watch it full time. Now, the only problem is, are they going to make it affordable? Because if they're going the way Formula One's going, I don't know how more and more people are still going to these race of weekends whenever it's getting more and more expensive. Like, this is essentially going to turn into people's summer holiday as a 3-day weekend just to go watch a Formula One race. It's that expensive. Got Silverstone is outrageous. You can go to a MotoGP race for the full weekend for 52 quid. Like, you could not go to Silverstone for 52 quid. You couldn't go to Silverstone for 52 quid for, like, the last 15 years, probably. But obviously, Liberty Media hasn't taken over that much since. But you're an expert on Silverstone money, so I'll let you interrupt me if you need to.
But I think last year, whenever the World Superbikes was at Donington Park, I went on the Friday for one of the practice day. And I think the ticket was £19, and that was on the gate. I could have got much cheaper earlier. That was the last minute decision.
So cheap.
And it was a really good day because I love Donington Park. Tom, you love Donington Park too. It's a great circuit. And for me going just with my camera, it was great. And the only problem was the crowd wasn't there. There was a lot in the infield and the camping, but around the circuit there wasn't a lot. Now that said, it's Friday, it's the same Silverstone, obviously a bigger crowd, but it's not as busy. I think on race days it was much busier. But for 19 quid, free parking, I got, you know, it's down the parks and it's a good location. It's easy to get to. It's just up the M1 or down the M1, whatever direction you're traveling in. And it was great. I really enjoyed it. The paddock was fully open. You could walk around the motorhomes. It was great. The riders were talking about, it felt to me as if you're going to a British GT race or just any national race where it's an open paddock. You could approach any driver. You go into the same bathroom as the riders. That's the sort of standard you're talking about. But they still made Donington Park look this as if it was Silverstone itself, this massive scale with all the sponsorship and branding. It was a great day, and I really enjoyed it. And I feel like for me, to slightly deviate away from that point, but what Liberty Media have bought, it's effectively two massive world championships in your own right. They're completely separate, where there's still a lot of crossover. Whenever MotoGP rider moves to World of Superbikes, they're immediately one of the title contenders, and then the season progresses, and all of a sudden they realise they're 7th or 8th fastest. There's just riders who are better than them, because from an outside perspective, they're effectively two motorbike world championships, same bikes, whatever. They're not. I think World Superbikes is more customer based, or more like you can go and buy it in the shops. There's an article somewhere on the website from about four years ago.
It's literally that you can buy the bike. It's literally a tuned bike with minor modifications such as suspension, tires, fueling, and an ECU reprogram. That's it. Whereas MotoGP is the whole bike has specialist kit. That's the difference between the two. That's it.
But they've bought effectively two championships that are two world championships, and I feel like this will be a good example for them on how they approach Formula One going forward, because if they see them making all these changes to MotoGP and then hits driving fans to World Superbikes, which is the secondary championship in their pecking order, they'll be thinking, well, hold on, Formula One fans, they're chitting away, or viewer figures are dropping. Oh, there's Formula E, who they don't own. Their numbers are rising, or the national racing is rising, because instead of a Sunday, people sitting down in front of the TV watching the European F1 races, they're heading to Alton Park or Brands Hatch to watch the British Touring Car Championship. Ultimately, that's great for British racing, but for Liberty Media, that's the worst thing that can happen, because you're going to a place where there's no signal, there's racing on the same time, there's competition there, and I feel like them buying Dorna will be a great example to them of what can happen whenever you put all your eggs in one basket, effectively, with a major championship, and then leave another championship just to sort of fight on his own. I could see them selling off World Superbikes potentially going forward.
All I'm going to say is until Sky Sports or TNT take on the TV rights for it, it ain't going to be nothing.
Well, obviously, yeah, MotoGP is obviously on TNT, but World Superbikes is on Eurosport.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You need and the two in the one. The two in the one.
Yeah.
Formula 1, yeah. Formula 2, Formula 3, and even F4, the F1 series, not whatever you call it. What's it called? The female one.
F1 Academy.
Yes, that's all on Sky Sports. You needed all motorbike stuff in the one place. Apart from the BBC NA for the Northwest, that's
yes. Well, we need Liam Beckett chatting about the tomato sandwiches and the ice cream van.
Exactly. We need that. Yes.
Yeah, I think obviously with TNT at the moment, you got Formula E and you got MotoGP, but because their weekends are focused on, full disclaimer, I do work for TNT some weekends as a graphics operator, so I sort of have a bit of insight into their operations. But obviously they're focused on the Saturday morning, early afternoons, the Premier League football, and then it's rugby on TNT 1, TNT 2, Friday night, Saturday evening, Saturday afternoon, Sunday, you know, both afternoon and then into the evening with the review show. It doesn't work for me at Formula E on TNT, for a start. I think it should be 3D air because it doesn't have the popularity behind it. But I think you're right, Brian. There needs to be one sort of collective push. And maybe with Liberty Media buying these, they'll obviously be dishing out the next time the media rights come out. You never know. If Sky Sports can get a hold of MotoGP and World Superbikes, I think it's going to cause problems because obviously there's a lot of clashing with Formula 1. But that would be an incredible challenge. I would be worth the subscription itself to have one place. I think it would be a great thing for Sky. Maybe they could have a separate channel, Sky Sports Motorbikes or Racing, something like that. They could have Sky Sports. They have Sky Sports Racing. That's a horse racing, but
just put it on Sky Showcase or Sky Sports.
Yeah, this mix. Or do they still have Sky Mix?
I'm not sure if you guys said this, but or you could just rename the F1 channel just Sky Motorsport or something like that. You guys might have said that.
Something along those lines would be good. But let's move on to our predictions now. And well, it's been a few races since we last did predictions on broadcast format, but we have been keeping up to date behind the scenes with them. We've been predicting each race, and we're four races in, and we're all level on 11 points, which I should say is a great number for us to be on given the disaster we had last year. So far I scored four races.
You had,
I was like 2 points behind you at the end up.
Yeah,
I had a great comeback at the end. I scored 4 points in the first race, so did Ryan. Tommy got three, then we all got three in the second race. The third race, I got two, Ryan got one, Tom got one, and then the last race, Tom, you did really well, you got four, Ryan, you got three, and I got two, which leaves us on 11 each. If my maths is correct, it's probably wrong, but we're on 11, so
considering we'll take I always have there. To help you.
Yeah, yes. We'll take it from there, 11. So this is obviously a sprint weekend as well, cue the excitement all around. But it does mean we have a lot more to predict, so we'll try to rattle through these as quickly
maximum
as possible.
Maximum 8 points is what's possible.
Yes.
That's some good going there.
Well, I'll save you the botheration of thinking for the start, because sprint pole position, for me, is going to be Max Verstappen.
You can put that for me as well.
Yeah. Ryan?
Yeah, this is it for me as well, yeah.
And are we all in agreement that he's also going to win the sprint race?
Yeah.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. And pole position for Sunday?
That's probably the greatest predictions for me.
Yeah. Pole Sunday, Max Verstappen, Ryan?
Sergio Perez.
Ooh. Okay. Tom?
Actually, I think I saw the track's been resurfaced, so he could quite definitely probably be someone else than Verstappen, but I'm going to go with Verstappen.
Playing safe. Yeah. Winner on Sunday, I'm obviously going for Verstappen. Ryan?
Perez.
Okay. Tom?
Verstappen.
Okay, so Ryan, this is either a masterclass or a major flaw for you. I feel like where we're going to pick up our points this year is very much going to be in the podium positions, because I think there's been quite a few predictions for like Sainz and Perez, and then last race it was it Leclerc and Norris, or at least Norris, Perez, whatever the podium was, but definitely creates a bit of intrigue. Podium for me, I'm gonna go Leclerc and Sainz, but Sainz second. Ryan.
Verstappen.
Okay, yeah.
And my name is Carlos Sainz.
To be fair, that's not a bad prediction to make, putting Verstappen, because if he does win the race, you still get that point.
Yeah, boy. So,
that's clever. Tom?
I think Perez and Sainz.
Okay, so if Sainz, we'll get 1 point Sainz, and then that second place or third place is going to be the decider there on that one. Fastest lap, I'm going to match Verstappen. Ryan?
Charles Leclerc.
Interesting. Okay. And Tom?
I'm going to go Carlos Sainz.
Okay. And Ryan, your random number generator, please.
Oh, it's ready to go.
Take it away.
Once, twice, three times. Number 59, closest to 59, is George Russell at 63.
You go down to Sainz 55, but I'll go for Russell.
Most of us have already predicted something for Sainz, so I'm just gonna say Russell.
Okay, Russell. Ooh, that's a tough one because Mercedes are pretty terrible at the moment.
Russell throws another tantrum.
I'm gonna do a multiple prediction one. So I qualifies Hamilton. Again, to make it 5-0.
Bingo.
And then finishes. I was gonna say fifth, but I still think that's a bit loose. Fifth.
I'd give top five.
Okay. Yeah. Because
it's not
yeah.
happening, but I'd give it.
Yeah, well, if you go on the basis that there's the fifth fastest team, well, then I think fifth is fair.
You also have to remember that Russell also hasn't driven this track since he was in a Williams.
But that's when a car that was probably better in the current Mercedes.
That's also very true.
Ryan, your turn.
Ah, me. 1, 2, 3, 19. Ooh, what's 19? 18, Lance Stroll, or 20. No, yeah, I could go up to Magnussen at 20 or Lance Stroll.
You know, I think Stroll's the funnier one.
Lanch. I like Lanch. Okay, we'll go for Lanch. Lanch is Strolly, Daddy's Cash. Daddy's Cash. I can literally make one bold claim here, and it's not going to happen, but it's bold enough as it stands that I don't have to add any extras to it. Can you guess what it is?
Max Q3?
No. Lance finishes higher than Alonso in the race.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's
never going to happen, but hey, yeah. At least I tried.
Yep. And one more time for Tom.
46? Oh, you lucky duck. 46.
Mick Schumacher, 47, making a return.
Lewis Hamilton,
is
it, 44.
Isn't Valentino Rossi 46?
he drove a Ferrari a few years back. He could be their fifth reserve driver, for all we know.
Yeah.
Drove a Mercedes as well, didn't he?
And you know what's funny?
Currently BMW factory as well, so they make
funny,
shock to.
Funny you used the last name, surname Rossi, because if on my list currently, is a driver called Alexander Rossi, who's American, who raced in the 2015 season. His number still shows up here as 53. It's still on this list of F1 drivers I have on this list. Which is weird.
Yeah. He won the Indy 500.
Oh.
And he is currently good. Drives for McLaren.
So realistically,
he's okay.
Your options here are Lewis Hamilton or Lewis Hamilton.
I think I have to go with Nicholas Hamilton.
Ah, yeah.
What could Lewis do then?
Retires straight away.
Straight away, doesn't make it around turn one.
Or if you want a real wild card, I just clicked it again. And it goes to number 74, which is 77's closest for Valtteri Bottas, which would be a very difficult prediction to make.
I think I've had Bottas in a previous week, so I think I'm going to go with
Stick with Hamilton.
Hammersheim. I always want to go with the ones where I say they get a podium, but then that does one of my things.
But it does give you an extra possibility. Did it work? Last week?
I can't remember.
I was right. You had that. I think you put for last week. You predicted Sainz to finish in the podium, and you didn't. But it was different from your actual podium prediction. I thought it was quite clever because it gives you two possible points.
I honestly can't even mind what I predicted.
Yeah.
I'll have to check our chat.
He's always been quite. Well, from what I remember him being. Well, I think we said he won last time in China, and he's not. It's not one of his. I don't think it's one of his bad circuits, and then it's been resurfaced. Can I steal yours, but then change it a little bit and say he finishes in the top four?
Yeah, because he hasn't qualified Russell at all this season, so I think that's fair.
Okay, top four finish then.
Top four?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine with me. I think that's all we've got time for in today's podcast. Back to the longer format ones. But yeah, we took a look at some of the good, the bad, the controversial moments from the world of Formula One. Ryan, Tom, thank you for joining me for this one. Thank you to everyone for listening, and we'll be back sometime soon. Don't know quite when, but we'll be back soon. We'll discuss all things China and wherever races after that. I think it's Miami. Yes, return to Miami, but we might be back after China. But yeah, make sure you follow us across all our social media platforms, our YouTube channel, subscribe to that so you don't miss out on any content here on Apex Motorsport. There'll be loads more coming out. It's been a little bit in the back burner for the past few weeks, different work schedules, and it's been absolute chaos, but there's loads of content coming out soon, so stay tuned for that. Once again, Ryan, Tom, thanks for joining me. Thank you everyone for listening, and hope you can join us in the next one. Goodbye.